Country in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two episodes with Ross Donlan, plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events from around the region. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Last week on Poetry on the Radio, we spoke with Ross Donlan about his poetry about his absent but powerfully present father, and about his sense of humor. We'll hear more about both subjects today. Sydney-raised, Ross Donlan now lives in Castlemaine, Victoria. He's widely published in Australia, Ireland, the UK, and elsewhere. He has written 5 full-length books of poetry, most recently The Bread Horse, and numerous chapbooks. His honors include the Varuna Dorothy Hewitt Flagship Fellowship in 2010 and winning 2 international poetry competitions. Ross convenes literary events under the banner Poetry from Agitation Hill and is the publisher of the poetry imprint Mark Time Books. A sequence of poems from his book, The Blue Dressing Gown, about his father, a World War II U.S. serviceman, formed the basis of a radio feature on the ABC poetry program Poetica in 2013. As we ended last week's episode, we were speaking with Ross about his gift for capturing the attention of listeners at readings and his delight in humorous poems. Let's listen to some of Ross Donlan's reading at the Poetry on the Move Festival in September 2022 here in Canberra.
Well, I was asked to begin with a disclaimer. So we do wish to advise that the following poems are rated M. For a mature audience, I think you're okay. They contain violence, nudity, a sex scene, and strong use of language. 69% of the content has been classified as sentimental, which may cause drowsiness in some listeners and increase the effects of alcohol. If so affected, you should not drive a motor vehicle or operate heavy machinery. If you're pregnant or hoping to conceive, don't listen. We do hope that you enjoy the poems, even that lights flicker on in your cortex, but in the unlikely event of an emergency, please brace yourself by holding tightly to a person near you. Now, you might like to negotiate a partner now, in case a refusal later offends. Oxygen masks will fall from the light fittings above. Please see to yourself before attending to children or the infirm. If it's necessary to abandon a poem entirely, listen for the conveniently placed line breaks and punctuation marks until you hear the last full stop. Then exit by sliding beneath the poem, mind the gap, and fall to the floor. Assume a fetal position and wait for further assistance. Please make sure that you take all your belongings with you. Any ideas left unattended will be taken away and plagiarized.
There's humor within many of Ross Donlan's poems too.
There are some poems about prostate surgery in there as well that I used to read a lot. I've had 2 lots of prostate surgery. So there's one called, I think, eight or 10 reasons to have a terp.
Here he talks about his eating chips with Jane Austen.
Now, I should say at the start that it's based on a poem by Galway Connell called Oatmeal, which he wrote about having oatmeal with John Keats. And then Bronwyn Ling, she's got one called Cheap Red Wine about getting drunk with Charles Baudelaire and passing out in his arms, so to speak. It's a beautiful poem.
Billy Collins has the one where he's undressing
Emily Dickinson.
And it puts me in mind of that a little bit because of humor.
It's interesting to read a funny poem. I read this in Sydney the other night, and I don't know that it went down with the audience, and sometimes it goes down very well. And there's a couple of poems that have got jokes in them, and it's interesting. There's a poem called Death in Rome, and there's a joke in there. And I've always been interested to hear who gets it and who doesn't get it. I was in Norway, and when I was doing these residencies, I often would
just be reading. Remember, one year I read all the Harry Potter books, and this year I was reading all of Jane Austen, and I was eating chips while I was reading Sense and Sensibility, I think it was. I often eat a packet of potato chips alone. I eat them with a can of beer while I watch a cooking program. This can make the chips taste like the dish chef is preparing, such as creme caramel or beef teriyaki. I know that it is not good to eat potato chips alone, so sometimes I invite Jane Austen to join me. Jane is always Jane, the perfect companion, reserved, tactful, gracious, demure, wise and generous. I like to observe her in profile as she sits near my aircon, bodice of her gown fluttering from the fan set on too, a book pleasantly in hand. She speaks little, but her responses to anecdotes regarding the shambles of my personal life are always expressed in a reassuring and compassionate manner. It cannot be quite as you say, sir. Surely it was never so bad as this. We must look an odd pair. She in her long-sleeved Regency gown, buttoned at the wrist, lace in place, hair drawn up in an understated style, posture both composed and relaxed. Me in my footy shorts and singlet, feet spread on the coffee table. I know from her half smile that she registers my attire and the period of time that separates us, but there is no condescension, no hint that a station has been passed. She evinces little interest in football, so we do not dwell for too long on the misfortunes of the Magpies and soft tissue injuries caused by playing on artificial surfaces. She is, of course, at her most entertaining and instructive in the matter of social intercourse, and I tell her that today she'd be well paid on a Dear Jane segment on daytime television. Jane colours a little at this, especially when I indicate that the complications of sexual relations are now rather more diverse than they were in her day. Suddenly animated, she says, "Sir, I beg to differ. The issue is always one of compatibility." Once, after another keenly felt rejection, I opined that my relationships resembled nothing so much as a pair of lonely jocks being tossed about in a cosmic washing machine, not even in the company of detergent. At this, Jane bent rather more closely to her book, but I sensed a rebuke when she said she regretted my unfortunate use of metaphor. I rushed to apologise, blaming the crassness of the age in which I live. "Sir," she replied, with a wry smile and sparkling eye, "I think you were born into the wrong time. You are all grace and courtesy, and surely the attachment of a fortunate woman will soon be yours." Eventually, an imposing gentleman comes to collect her, no doubt a hybrid of Mr. Darcy and Captain Wentworth. Mm-hmm. He nods briefly in my direction before offering Jane his arm. Remembering my manners, I offer them each chips and a can of beer. Darcy Wentworth appears somewhat taken aback by my hospitality, and to tell the truth of the matter, I am by now so covered in crumbs and small pieces of chip they look rather like a big potato chip myself. But Jane, ever Jane, smiles and declines with sublime courtesy, and together they walk through the wall. Thank you.
I was going to move us then just to talk a little bit more about what you're doing recently.
Yeah.
You've been writing ghazals?
I have. I never know precisely how to pronounce it. I remember someone saying that's the sound a gazelle makes when it dies, but I don't believe that. I gather it's guzzle somewhere way down in the back of the throat.
That's right.
Mm. And for some reason, I tripped over them a few years ago, and it's a form that really suits me. There's a lot of form I can't write in, and there's some I can. But I love the fact that they're kind of broken, but somehow together, that you can come at a subject in a broken kind of way. And the skill is, if you can do it, to sort of somehow still keep it together.
Mm.
And I love the fact that you can have a word or a phrase or a subject about which you're quite obsessed, and you can actually hit the end of each couplet with that particular word. And if you can get away with it without it becoming boring for the reader or the listener, then yeah, I like the fact that I have to keep on hitting that particular word. And if you can do the other part where there's the refrain that precedes the word, which I sometimes try to do as well.
Mm.
I'm hoping, of course, to put together a collection of them, if I can get to 50. So my friend Trish wrote a poem that had Madonna in it. I've never really been a Catholic. I certainly was raised a Catholic. But the word struck me from the sonnet that she sent me, and I was really fought it. I really didn't want to write a poem about Madonna, but then I couldn't not. It didn't turn out the way I thought it was going to turn out. I mean, you know that lovely expression, how do I know what I think until I see what I say?
Mm.
You start off writing and you've got no...
Yes.
And suddenly this comes out. So Madonna. Enter the boy's own, not centre page, black and white photographs of Madonna. Young, naked pawn limbs, half open to the passive camera. Playgirl Madonna. First reference in Firefox. Google how you will. Start up your search engines, you'll only find Madge. Madonna Louise Ticcioni, Queen of Pop, Madonna. In the beginning, the word rocks out of the Beatles' top 10 hit. Up for a laugh, cocking a snoot, us being lads. Wasn't she someone's one-time lady, Madonna? In a sepulchral shop window, lines of plastic statues, trademark, downcast eyes, outstretched hands, piteous acceptance, stereotypical import, China Madonna. Somewhere in history, she was 14. Joe, her builder boy, may be rather older. Theologians and historians spin wheels of self-interest, but what's lost is Madonna. Poor wee girl, swallowed by a god, or gods, transformed by blind fate and faith into circus icon, Christmas card, morning star. But what about Mary, Madonna? Next to central figure in every nativity scene, each barn animal iconic, virgin womb borrowed for immaculate conception and Christmas delivery, blue Madonna, queen of heaven with no king, Matthew 1:19. Joseph, being a just man and not willing to make a public example, was minded to put her away privately, his ex, Madonna. Spread below the cross like a blanket, the eyes uplift asking, but no answer there, from the gathering of grey clouds streaked with someone's heaven, Pietà Madonna. Blue cream plaster sorrowful statue, incense everywhere, welcomes the poor and penitent, Our Lady, more working class sufferer than someone's sainted martyr, the people's Madonna. My mother's go-to, another woman then, who found trouble in war with men, familiar face from childhood, looking back sad, suffering, and kind, my Madonna. So isn't it interesting where they come from and how they go?
Mm.
So I was confirmed and all that. I was the only one that used to go to Mass, I remember, and everyone else would stay home reading the papers and having breakfast in bed. And I'd go off and come back with the branch for Palm Sunday and all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they got me confirmed. And one day I said, look, I don't want to go to Mass. Can I stay home and read the papers? And they said, yeah, okay. And that was their divide.
That was Catholicism. It, hey?
But this is the way, I mean, interesting about how a poem can be made. I mean, whether it's a good poem or a bad poem, I don't know. But, you know, you think, oh, I'm going to write something about Madonna. So I did go on to Safari or something and typed her in, thinking I was going to get something about the religious figure. And up came Madonna.
Let's listen to some of Ross Donlan's presentation at the monthly Manning Clark House reading in July 2023 here in Canberra.
Who's played netball here? Who's been to New York? Who's been to Newland? Where's Newland, says you? It's between Daylesford and Creswick. That doesn't help you very much, does it? Netball in Newlyn. Newlyn is quiet. Only shadows play in the park. Then netball lights flicker, kick on. Drills start. As stars connect above the court. A tiny turquoise planet. Gold rings at each end. Light bulbs grow worlds freckled with moths. Girls run and shout. Sneakers squeak. A mum calls out instructions. And I'm glad there's netball in Newlyn. A blink and you missed it place. Whose lights dissolve as you climb the hill. It gives me heart to see them train. To run and pass almost by instinct. It reminds me of how we make and do in Newlyn or New York or anywhere someone tries to do something more than survive a night and day. It's why I write, to move space, imagine, make order of emotion, thought and action, and try to score a goal. This is one about my grandmother, and it's a guzzle. This is called Apron. My grandmother stands at the kitchen sink of our small flat, wearing her favourite apron, tied at the back, the loops too hard for a small boy to ignore, the granny knot of her apron. Not bought, but made. The Singer pedal sewing machine rattles across cheap cotton cloth, edges hemmed with a vibrant match, red rickrack braid trims her black and white apron. Solitary at the sink, small statue in the after hours of washing, peeling, cooking, wiping, and putting away. The long grey work skirt sways, steps of a kitchen ritual, solitary dance in a new apron. Summer sunlight angles into the narrow window of the flat, turns sink suds into snowflakes. But heat beats the kitchen like a gong, baking his baked dinner, grease stains on her apron. Fireside, winter's kerosene heater, a cozy name with different connotations in small flat life, tripping not allowed under spell of Dante's Inferno. Clothes horse stable for her drying apron. Family gone, alone at last but bereft, that family paradox, children departed, but left with his ghost. Daily teacup and saucer, the best too fine for breaking, breaking nonetheless, falling from her apron. A kind of hopscotch on the kitchen linoleum, Parkinson calls with respect, short jumps into hospital, 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 nursing home, bedridden, that odd phrase, independence gone with her apron. A protective garment worn over the front of one's clothes, tied at the back. We all need protection. From the old French, Napperon, the N in Napperon, lost by wrong division. Time will do that. Our apron. Child point of view of an adult growing older. Nan's shanks narrow into slippers. Varicose veins bulge from a lifetime of standing. I reach and undo the strings. Again, not looking up, she reties her apron. The ones with Jen, one poem she sent had the Bayeux tapestry in it. And I realised all my life I've had a poem inside me about the Battle of Hastings. And Harold Godwinson and the arrow. You've all seen it. And I did a little bit of research and discovered that he was so badly hacked at the end of the Battle of Hastings, they couldn't identify him. Only one person could, not his wife, a woman known as his handfast partner, Edith, and she recognized him. Stay tuned. And this is a sonnet. In fact, a little writer's secret, I wrote the poem just like that and discovered I had 13 lines. And I thought, I can turn this into a sonnet. So I found another line. And excuse me, I couldn't just leave it with Bayeux Tapestry because Roy Orbison got into my head in that song of his called Blue Bayeux. Blue Bayeux? So I called it Blue Bayeux. I know, what can you do? Why does the life and carnage-strewn death of Harold Godwinson call me today? 1066 and all that. 2023 and all that. His battles with sword and halberd for his state and legacy, mine in the fairground of my own. Imagine having your life retold and reworked in a linen comic strip, and you unable to say nay to a stitch, his, your ethics held up to light and found wanting, academics itching to retell a story in their image. Even your death, an arrow held fast into your eye like a telescope, stitched, unstitched, and restitched to make a propaganda tapestry. What did you see, Harold, as the fletched missile struck? Eternity? My arrow is still in flight, but sure as if Robin Hood were Archer, I know it was launched at my birth and is somewhere on its way. Yet I envy his identification by the swan-necked Edith, his handfast partner, marks on his chest, part of the little left unspoiled that day, that only she would know, intimate, loving, probably love bites. Anybody else here have strabismic amblyopia? Strabismic amblyopia is pretty much what you'd imagine. One of your eyes is born an alien. And the brain, that hard driver, can't fuse contrasting images, so backs the straight one, and the turned or maligned eye can't develop, and so is called names, like lazy, wandering, and sees the world aslant. It was exciting in childhood, especially after Saturday afternoon at the flicks, to compare the blink the wanderer produced with the tricks of Superman, feeling moments away from the gift of flight. Back then, while the healthy one fetched and carried, foraged, hunted and procreated in a straight line towards death, the other believed it could see through mirrors, around doors, beyond the clasp of hands, inside a heart, into a poem. These days, the two act more or less in tandem, one with a direct line to the imagination, the other helping with spelling, grammar, and punctuation. Now I read Cicadas or Cicadas. Growing up in Ashfield in Sydney, in that flat, we thought the locusts were in an acorn tree. It's only much later I discovered there were cicadas in an oak tree. They came to us from far away, their older selves left like suitcases by the door. We crunched them as we trod to school and crushed the shells to crystal. When summer broke above the small backyards, and hot wind woke the neighbour's tree, we caught cicadas clinging to the leaves, shook until they screamed, stripped the fairy wings, tiny stained glass windows fluttering down, then squeezed until they pissed inside our fists. Once we kept some in a cage, feeding them with boredom, watching as they tried to understand the metal floor, the sand, and plastic swing, but found them in the morning on their backs, as though they'd crashed while racing in the dark, feelers gesturing, bodies posed for photographs. We went off to explore the choco vines and trails of rainbows left behind by snails, our petal eyes wide open, our faces pushed like feelers into leaves, and the mystery of chocos. Still learning how to see. It's one for my grandfather, who was a great horseman.
Well, he's a great gambler. And it's called The Days of Horses. Grandfather lived his week for the days of horses. I cut from newspapers on a floor full of horses. He'd be propped up in bed, old man mountain god, crumpled as form guides and sports pages of horses. Linoleum stretched a circular course around the room. A full-length mirror captured the turn for glass horses. The radio sang its minaret song all Saturday long. Afternoons called the galloping names of invisible horses. God in bed rocked the springs. 6-4 the field. 2-1 bar one. Bookies cheered his lost horses. The call's wordplay made for afternoon mysteries, repeating but changing the story of Saturday horses. Rising fast, Tim Whiffler, the grafter, White Nose, Peter Pan, Comic Court, Rain Lover, Lantern, Spearfelt, the language of horses. Around and around they swept through my Saturdays, the first spoken poems made by the racing of horses. I believe that actually, all the combination of strange words that were made up horse names of those days.
On today's episode and last week's, we've heard from Ross Donlan. Next week, we'll speak with Anne M. Carson, and in following weeks, with Keith Harrison and others. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, September 4, at Smith's Alternative in Civic, Jeff's Poetry presents John Fulcher and Suzanne Edgar. Suzanne Edgar was raised in Glenelg, Adelaide, before moving to Canberra, where while working part-time at the ANU, she wrote short stories and later poetry. She has published 3 book collections of poems with Port Adelaide publisher Stephen Matthews, Ginninderra Press. John Fulcher's 12 books of poetry include Dancing with Stephen Hawking from Pitt Street Poetry 2021. During a 40-year career, he has won or been shortlisted for many awards, including the National Library Poetry Prize, the Newcastle Poetry Prize, the ACU Poetry Prize, the Peter Porter Poetry Prize, and the Gwen Harwood Poetry Prize. On Monday, September 18, at Smith's, as part of that poetry thing, 2 recent Work Press poets debut new collections. Ez Fung, also known as Waffle Iron Girl, is a poet, flash fictionista, and spoken word performer whose poems have appeared in Australian Poetry Journal, Rabbit Poetry, Calliope X, and the Best of Australian Poems 2022 anthology. Brendan Ryan is the author of 6 collections of verse, the latest The Lowlands of Moyne from Walea Press 2019. His poetry has appeared in the Best Australian Poems series from Black Ink, Contemporary Australian Poetry from Puncher and Wattman, and the Anthology of Australian Prose Poetry. Marion Riders is offering a 2-part intensive online masterclass pitched to publisher with Julia Carlomagno on Saturday, September 9 and Saturday, September 16 from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. each day. Julia Carlomagno is the publisher and director at Monash University Publishing. Topics covered will include researching the right publisher, crafting a pitch, and publisher expectations of manuscripts. For more information, go to Marion Ryder's website at marion.ink. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded First Nations country in the studios of Art Sound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produce the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Australian pianist Gabriella Smart's album Chinese Whispers. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.